Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have Boston University's 25th Great Debate, sponsored by the College of Communications Department of Journalism. Modeled after the Cambridge and Oxford University Union Society's public discussions, the Great Debate brings together alumni, faculty, and students in a lively but collegial forum to discuss current issues in communication and public affairs. In the tradition of audience-centered parliamentary debate, the Great Debate involves a series of speeches alternating for and against the topic and includes audience participation as the audience decides the outcome of the debate by voting with their feet and moving to the side of the room representing their decision. Tonight's question is, should biofuels and the renewables be critical components of U.S. energy policy? Introducing our speakers is tonight's moderator, Boston University Journalism Department Chairman Robert Zelnick.
Welcome, everybody, to the 25th in the series of great debates sponsored by the Department of Journalism here at Boston University. Our question tonight is, should biofuels and the renewables be critical components of U.S. energy policy? The question may seem strange at a time when gasoline prices exceed $3.25 a gallon, when sweet Saudi crude has soared past the $100 per barrel benchmark, and when much of the industrialized world invites the United States to join the battle against greenhouse gases. One intuitively feels that any new option is superior to the status quo. However, alternatives to our current practices must themselves credibly promise better results ahead. Critical threshold questions must be asked. Can the new source come on stream in amounts sufficient to make a dent in the problem? Does production of the alternatives consume fewer resources, including land and water, than current practice? Is large-scale production economically viable within a reasonably predictable future? We're learning quickly that expert opinion divides precipitately on these questions. Tonight, we welcome a panel of debaters whose credentials suggest the ability to define the issues crisply and to support their positions with intelligence and conviction. Representing the affirmative side of the debate are Brooke Coleman. He's president of the New Fuels Alliance, arguing the negative side of the debate. Robert Bryce, managing editor of Energy Tribune magazine and author of Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence. We also have two student debaters, Neil St. Clair from the College of Communication and the College of Arts and Sciences. He's a double-edged fellow and a fine scholar. And Ashwan Walpita, class of 09 from the School of Management. As is traditional, the lead affirmative debater will speak for 15 minutes, followed by the lead negative debater. Then each student, beginning with the affirmative, shall speak for 7 minutes. I shall keep careful track of time and ring a bell when the speaker has 1 minute remaining. I'll ring it again when his time has expired, whereupon he should conclude his sentence and retire. Should I rise as I ring, the speaker is requested to halt forthwith. Then we will give members of the audience the opportunity to make arguments of up to a minute and 30 seconds, endorsing either the positive or negative side of the debate. They shall not interact with members of the debating teams, nor direct questions specifically to them. Then I'll ask the House to divide, with those concluding that the affirmative had the better of the arguments, gathering in the area to my right, your left, while those concluding that the negative won the day gather to my left, your right. I'll then announce the winner, and we shall repair to a fine Boston restaurant, oblivious to our disputes earlier in the evening. One further note, as this program is modeled on the Oxford-Cambridge style of debate, we discourage members of the audience from showing their approval or disapproval of the arguments by cheering, booing, applauding, or hissing. Those moved beyond containment are welcome to show their support with a hearty hear, hear, while those painfully afflicted by a debater's point are invited to say shame. Now let the debate begin with Mr. Coleman arguing biofuels and renewables should be critical components of U.S. energy policy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm the lucky one that gets to go first and lead on the 25th BU great debate. I don't know if anybody has been reading the newspapers about energy, but I hope none of you have been reading anything from this side of the room, but this could be an interesting debate. I am not a professional debater. I'm not debate trained, but I'm smart enough to know that as an affirmative speaker, I'm supposed to stand up here and wave my arms around and say, biofuels are the greatest thing in the world. Renewable energy is the greatest thing in the world. It will save us all from the dooms of foreign oil dependence and climate change. Then the guy that's written the book about the dangerous delusions of energy independence and his team will come up here and call me delusional, and they will explain to you just exactly where I've gone wrong, and I don't think I like that outcome. So I'm going to do something a little bit different. I don't know if page one of the debate handbook says don't do this, but I'm going to try to tell you what they're going to say and tell you why it's wrong right off the bat. And that does not mean that I'm some great intellectual and that I can tell you exactly what they're going to say because I have a crystal ball. What that means is that the criticisms of biofuels in particular, and that is one of the words that is let out of the title of this debate, are incredibly predictable. I've been doing this for 10 years. It doesn't matter whether you're on the far, far left and biofuels are not good enough a clean energy solution to be in the clean energy debate. It does not matter if you are on the far right and you stand up and you say that biofuels are a bad idea because they are a joke. Everybody sort of comes together around some typical themes, and so I'm going to hit a couple of them. Subsidies are my favorite. It goes something like this. Ethanol is a taxpayer boondoggle. Because not only is it subsidized itself, but corn is also subsidized. You will notice in every time that someone criticizes biofuels based on subsidies, they tend to leave out the context. They don't really tell you how subsidies in this space work. Well, let me explain that to you. The context, very basically, is that all energy solutions, all alternative energies, and actually the energies that we use every day are subsidized in the United States. Is that ideal? No. Is it true? Absolutely. So that means that it kind of changes your perspective a little bit. If you look at the last time we passed an energy bill in this country in 2005, and it takes us through 2009 in terms of subsidies, 86% go to the fossil fuel industry. 86% go to the fossil fuel industry. The second thing you need to know is that when people show up and they say, well, you know, ethanol subsidized, for example, biodiesel subsidized, well, it's subsidized on two fronts, right? You got corn, massive subsidies over there. And then you got ethanol subsidized itself, right? Well, let's start with corn. Why is corn subsidized? Corn is subsidized. It's been subsidized for decades. Doesn't really have a whole lot to do with ethanol, frankly. It's subsidized, and this is how it works. The U.S. government subsidizes loser crops. The crops that fail get subsidized so they don't completely bail, okay? Corn has been a loser crop forever. And what they don't tell you is that the demand for ethanol, which has increased the demand for corn, has brought up the price of corn, and has pulled corn off the federal payrolls. I think it's worth mentioning that ethanol has increased the demand for corn and taken corn off the payrolls to the tune of $6 billion in 2006 alone. Does it mean that we have perfect ag policies in this country? Absolutely not. Now let's switch over to the blending requirement. Insidiously, ethanol is also subsidized there as well. So you go and you say, I'll give you 51 cents a gallon if you blend ethanol. Well, guess who gets that subsidy? The oil industry gets that subsidy. Why do they get that subsidy? Because you can't pass a subsidy without talking to the oil industry. There's a common theme here, and that is that the oil industry is the one duping our energy policies, not the biofuels industry. They're playing in the space. Food versus fuel. This is one of my favorites all over the place. Reasoning goes something like this. Biofuels increase the demand for grain. Price of grain goes up. Food comes out of poor people's mouths, right? Problem is, that makes intuitive sense, and it really pulls at people's heartstrings. Problem is, grain prices are only a tiny fraction of what we pay for food. Tiny fraction. You're not paying for grain. You're paying for labor. You're paying for transportation, $4.25 diesel. You're paying for packaging, which is largely petroleum-based. You're paying for really expensive TV ads, and you're making sure that the Nabiscos of this world make billions of dollars. Any credible analysis of the food issue, including the one several weeks ago in the Boston Globe, will tell you that the primary driver behind increased food prices is one simple thing, Common theme, increase in oil prices. Well, what the heck is a credible analysis? Well, I'll tell you what a credible analysis is not. I've read a lot of Robert Bryce's book. He's going to come up after me. The study he quotes is a May 2006 study, and that study was funded by the livestock industry. So is that bad? Well, let me tell you about the livestock industry. By far and away, the largest consumer of corn in this country, by far and away, is a cow. We grow corn largely to feed cows. The livestock industry, they'd rather enjoy the subsidized corn that goes down to $1.80 a bushel, which is below cost in terms of what it costs to produce it. Cows gobble up all the cheap feed. They make a ton of money. Everybody's happy, right? Well, they're not too pleased with the ethanol industry coming along and increasing the price of corn, so they go out and they commission a bunch of studies. That food for fuel article that was the May 2006 one started the food for fuel debate. So let's say that you believe me and that oil is really the one that's getting us in the grocery aisles. What about all the poor people? One of the great myths in the food debate is that the United States shows up with a tanker in all these malnourished countries and says, here's a bunch of corn, thank God we're here. We're going to fix your problems by feeding you our corn. 55% of our corn exports go to rich countries like Japan. Why do we send them to Japan? Well, because they can pay for them. This is the United States of America. We tend to sell things to people who can pay for them. Less than 0.5% of the corn that we grow ends up in the 10 most malnourished countries on this planet. It's simply a total myth. Let's look at a couple more real quick, really quickly. Energy balance. You've all heard this article. This is a 10-year-old issue, right? It takes more energy to make a gallon of biofuel than you get out of it. This is a funny one because everybody always quotes the same two guys, Professor Pimentel at Cornell and Tad Patzick at UC, in the UC system. Professor Pimentel in Cornell, he's an entomologist, studied bugs, thinks that we should reduce population to deal with climate change. Okay, is he wrong? Maybe, maybe not. Tad Patzick is an oil industry veteran who more or less uses the same inputs as Pimentel. Is it bad to mention them? No. Should you also mention the other folks that say that ethanol has a net positive energy balance, folks like UC Berkeley, the Natural Resource Defense Council, Department of Energy, the Department of Agriculture, Climate Solutions, one of the most respected climate environmental nonprofits in the country? Well, those groups didn't make it into Robert Bryce's book. Those groups not only have said that ethanol has a positive energy balance, but they've said that it has a better energy balance than gasoline. Why is that important? Because these are alternatives to gasoline. If we're going to take a step in the right direction, I'd say we should start taking a step with something that has a positive energy balance. One of the ones I like a lot is ethanol costs more. Why in the world does everybody say, I could stand up here and say ethanol costs less than gasoline. Robert's probably going to come up or someone else is going to come up and say, well, actually it costs more. Well, what the heck is going on there, right? Two seemingly educated people. Well, I can only give you the facts. And the facts are that yesterday, the spot price of ethanol was 20 cents cheaper than gasoline. But that doesn't include the blender's credit. I mentioned 50 cents a gallon. So the oil companies get an additional 50 cents a gallon, bringing the net savings to 70 cents a gallon. Now, I know some people will jump on me and say, well, why would you include the blender's credit? That seems like a cheap shot. Well, why wouldn't you? If you're going to compare a gallon of gasoline with subsidies embedded to a gallon of ethanol without them, aren't you creating an apples to oranges comparison? Yes. Most of the people that say that ethanol is more expensive and point to charts where ethanol is slightly more expensive, look beneath the chart. You will find that they've taken out the 50 cents. Don't start taking subsidies out of one side and not the other. They're either all in or they're not. And that's why the Consumer Federation of America, hardly a bastion of biofuel thought, released a report that said that ethanol is saving consumers billions. The last one's the hardest, climate change. And this is the newest one. This is the only one that hasn't been around forever. You might have heard in all of the major newspapers that now biofuels are worse than gasoline. How did this happen? Well, this is what happened. About 20 years of carbon life cycle science said that biofuels are marginally or moderately better than gasoline. Pretty much everybody was on the same page. Scientific community said, yeah, that's about right. So what happened? Well, what happened was during that 20 years, we studied the direct impacts. What happens when you burn it? What happens when you produce it? What happens when you change a field over from grazing a cow on it to a cornfield? These are tangible things that we can sort of study and understand. One study in Science a couple months ago came out and said, we need to think about indirect impacts. Absolutely correct, we do. But that's what happened. We started looking at the ripple effect. what happens if, well, if we increase corn here, then people stop growing soybeans here, and then, well, I think we're going to grow more soybeans in Brazil, and where are we going to grow them, on the Cerrado? Are we going to grow them in the rainforest? That is a new scientific world that we are going to get into. But it is going to take some time to figure that out. Is this happening now? The truthful answer, before you start saying that biofuels are worse than gasoline, is not yet. Increases in corn supply from 06 to 07 more than made up for the increased ethanol demand in this country, which means there was no sort of fall off in exports that would require Brazil or China or India to make up the difference. Could this happen? Absolutely. But critics leave stuff out of this controversial issue, just like they leave stuff out of the other issues I've mentioned. This is the big one. In December of 2007, the federal government passed another energy bill, and they were aware of what was going on with land use concerns. They were aware of what was going on with climate concerns. And so in the federal energy bill, they required all new biofuels to meet very stringent greenhouse gas standards, and they had a land use protection clause, which means you can't clear land and produce biofuel on it. Is it a perfect solution to the problem? No. It is almost never mentioned. This is the regulatory framework under which biofuels folks operate. Congressman Markey, from right around here, was one of the biggest proponents of making sure that that control was in there. It was a brutal part of the negotiations. It's almost like it doesn't exist for folks like this. So why did the newspapers fall for it? How the heck could I be telling the truth and they all not be telling the truth? Well, it's just a simple issue of not reading the fine print. There's a study. It's super technical. They go out. The study says, what's my primary assumption? I'm going to assume 30 billion gallons of corn ethanol demand in this country. We're at 8. If you take an economic equilibrium model and you want to make it say something big, the best thing you can do is take the initial market, multiply it by 4, jam it in there, and see all the stuff that flies out. If we go to 30 billion gallons a year in this country, I can honestly say, and I bet the folks I'm debating would agree with me, we got a problem. But the federal energy bill stops at 15 billion gallons all the way through 2022. Why? Because everybody that was in the room knew that when we get past there, we got issues. We got issues. So we got to make sure that we have the proper context in all of these situations. Now, I'm supposed to be an affirmative speaker, so that part of it's over. So are biofuels the silver bullet? I don't want to just sit here and rail on the criticisms of the criticisms, and then I just become a naysayer of naysayers, and it makes no sense. So the truth is that biofuels are an energy solution that is, for the most part, good and has the potential to be great. The good part comes from several things. The jobs biofuels have created in desperate rural economies, the revenues created for states in a tough economy, the marginal gains on, dare I say it, increased energy security. You might notice that as all our states on the coasts have energy issues and have budget deficits, there's this group of states in the middle that don't have budget deficits. If you talk to the people out there and you ask them why, the first thing will come out of their mouth, our agricultural sector is thriving. A lot of it has to do with biofuels. Is this evil? Depends on who you talk to. If you talk to people on the coast, well, maybe it's not the most perfect energy solution. Maybe we need to do it carefully. Evil? I don't think so. It has been a tremendous boon for agricultural sectors that haven't seen that type of spiking in their economy in decades. The great part comes on the advanced biofuel side. We are in the research and development phase, but there are a lot of smart people who have invested in advanced biofuels, fuels that are made from algae, fuels that are made from waste. There's 5 billion gallons of ethanol in corn cobs that we throw away every day. That's leaving some of the corn cobs on the 5 billion gallons of fuel from a complete waste product. Does that mean that we should, we should cover our entire country in corn? Of course it doesn't mean that, but our entire country is covered in corn. So we have to deal with some of these solutions and solve some of these problems based on reality. The folks that are investing in these companies, the Mascomas, the Agrivitas, the Bioenergy Internationals, there's a huge cluster of them right here in Boston that are trying to crack this nut. The people that are investing in these companies are not basing their decisions on what they read in books and read in blogs. They're basing these decisions on sound economic reasoning, and I, I, I will cede the rest of my seconds. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brook. Our next speaker, representing the negative side of the argument, is Robert Bryce.
Thank you. Pleased to be here. Should biofuels and renewables be critical components of U.S. energy policy? Our answer is no. Biofuels are increasing food prices and increasing greenhouse gas emissions. I'll be followed by Ashan Walpita. He will discuss the fact that expanded biofuel use will increase geopolitical uncertainty, particularly in the developing world, as food prices increase and food scarcity affects economic growth. Now, let me be clear. We are not opposed to biofuels and renewables. We are opposed to mandates and subsidies. First, biofuels are increasing food prices, and they are increasing greenhouse gas emissions. Let me be clear. Corn ethanol is perhaps the biggest and longest-running scam of American taxpayers in history. What we are doing is fiscal insanity. We are making subsidized motor fuel out of the single most subsidized crop in America, that's corn. In 2005, corn subsidies were $9.4 billion. What's $9.4 billion? It's approximately equal to the entire budget of the U.S. Department of Commerce, which has 39,000 employees. Again, this is fiscal insanity. And as we pursue this fiscal insanity, we are subjecting ourselves to a myriad of other problems that include, but are not limited to, rapidly increasing food prices, worsening air quality, depletion of our water resources, increased oil consumption, worsening greenhouse gas emissions, and that's just a partial list. Of the items on that list, what are the most important? Well, I will argue, to begin, that food prices and greenhouse gases are the biggest issues. If you want more hunger and a hotter planet, then cooking up more biofuels is a recipe to achieve just that end. The facts. Over the past 2 years, corn prices have more than doubled and soybeans have nearly tripled. In 2007 alone, food prices here in the U.S. increased by nearly 5%, double the rate of inflation. Some ag economists, including Bill Lapp of Omaha, are now expecting that food prices will increase at an annual rate of 7.5% for each of the next 5 years. Why are food prices rising? Well, clearly growing global demand. As China, India, other developing countries get wealthier, those people are eating more poultry, they're eating more meat, and they're eating more of the foods that we enjoy. Rising energy prices, clearly having an impact on food prices, as Mr. Coleman pointed out. The weak dollar is a contributing factor, no question about it. But the key reason for rising food prices, and the one that is ultimately easily avoidable, the ethanol scam. The United States Department of Agriculture now estimates global grain demand this year will grow by 5.2%. Fully half of that increase is coming from U.S. consumption of corn for ethanol. In 2006, according to the National Corn Growers Council, these aren't my numbers, 2006, 20% of the American corn crop was diverted into ethanol production. By next year, 2009, again, according to the corn growers, 4 billion bushels, some one-third of the expected crop, will be diverted to make motor fuel at a time when we have no shortage of motor fuel. None of us on the negative side are economists, but the law of supply and demand is very clear. We believe that if you divert a third, 25%, a third of the corn crop into making motor fuel, taking it out of the grain market, it will affect prices. And that is just what is happening. Early last year, tens of thousands of people marched in Mexico City to protest rising tortilla prices. Why are tortilla prices rising? Because the price of corn is rising. The BBC quoted the economy minister Eduardo Soho, who blamed directly the diversion of corn in the U.S. Into ethanol for rising food prices. In May 2007, Mr. Coleman said that I only quoted in my book studies supposedly funded by the livestock industry. I don't know what he's talking about, but I did cite one study that is very clear. Now, if Iowa State University is in the throes of the pay of the livestock industry, it's news to me. But nevertheless, the Center for Agricultural and Rural Development at Iowa State University in May of 2007 released a report which says the ethanol mandates have increased the food bill for every American by $47. That is due, they said, directly to the rising cost of corn and other grains. The researchers concluded that due to these higher food prices, American consumers are enduring a, quote, total cost of ethanol of about $14 billion. And that does not include the billions of dollars in federal subsidies for corn growers or the 51 cent per gallon tax credit that goes to the ethanol producers and blenders. In February of this year, William Doyle, the CEO of Potash Corporation, based in Saskatchewan, world's largest maker of crop nutrients, pointed out that the amount of grain now in storage around the world is near all-time lows. Mr. Doyle warned that if there is a major drought or other natural disaster that affects these low global grain supplies, he said, quote, "I believe you'd see famine." In early March, Pilgrim's Pride, the world's largest poultry processor, shuttered a plant in Siler City, North Carolina, and laid off 1,100 workers. The company's CEO, Clint Rivers, laid the blame squarely on the ethanol mandates, saying that, quote, "there is much more to come," end quote, in the way of food prices. And he said, quote, "we're spending our tax dollars to raise the price of our food to subsidize the ethanol industry." Late last month, the finance minister of India, P. Chidambaram, gave a speech in Singapore in which he singled out the American ethanol industry for its inflationary effect on global food prices. He said the ethanol mandates are, quote, "outrageous," end quote, and, quote, "must be condemned." Congressional meddling in the energy market has created what Lester Brown, the president of the Earth Policy Institute, calls a, quote, "epic competition between the world's supermarkets and its service stations." Therein, ladies and gentlemen, lies the perversity of the ethanol mandates. As the global economy heads for rougher times, thanks to the mortgage subprime meltdown, rising energy prices, food prices are soaring. And as these prices increase, they are increasing anxiety among consumers who will further reduce their discretionary spending. When it comes to food prices, Congress has created a feedback loop that will reverberate in the global economy for years to come. And Congress is making things worse. In December, they passed the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007, which mandates the production of 36 billion gallons of ethanol and biofuels by 2022. It's a five-fold increase over current levels. We haven't seen the beginning of food prices if Congress has its way with this destructive policy. A final point on food and ethanol. No matter how much the pro-biofuel side talks about reducing oil use and energy security, the numbers just don't add up. Here's why. Even if the U.S. converted all of its corn into ethanol, it would provide 6% of America's oil use, or oil needs, forgive me. Again, if we converted all of our corn, 11 billion bushels or so last year, into ethanol, it would provide 6% of America's oil needs. What about biodiesel? I live in Austin, Texas. I love Willie Nelson. You know, he's marketing biodiesel, and I love Willie and all of his pot-smoking buddies back in Austin. But the idea that biodiesel is going to save us when it comes to our needs for oil is crazy. The U.S. uses about 43 billion gallons of diesel fuel per year. Soybeans are a favored source for making biodiesel. Farmers can produce about 40 bushels of soybeans per acre, yielding about 60 gallons of biodiesel. Thus, to replace all the diesel fuel used in America on an annual basis, farmers would have to plant 716 million acres in soybeans. That's 1.6 times all of the cultivated land available in this country. Put another way, even if all of the 3.2 billion bushels of soybeans produced by American farmers in 2006 were converted into biodiesel, it would yield only 4.8 billion gallons of diesel fuel, or about 1.5% of America's total oil needs. Just for the sake of discussion, let's assume we go ahead and do that and convert all of our corn and all of our soybeans into motor fuel. It will provide about 1.5 million barrels of oil per day, oil equivalent per day. We currently use nearly 21 million barrels of oil per day. That would be 7.5% if we use all of our corn, all of our soybeans, and turn them into biofuels, provide 7.5% of our oil needs, and we wouldn't have anything to eat. Again, the numbers just don't add up. The only reason that we have the quantities of biofuels now being produced today is because of mandates and subsidies. Now, greenhouse gases. The truth of the matter is that petroleum fuels are superior to biofuels when it comes to greenhouse gases. I repeat, because it's counterintuitive, it doesn't seem like it makes sense. I repeat, petroleum-based fuels are superior to biofuels when it comes to greenhouse gases. Mr. Coleman mentioned the Science Magazine report, in fact, published on February 7th. I can send you the link if you like. Study found that accounting for land use changes, corn ethanol production, quote, nearly doubles greenhouse emissions over 30 years and increases greenhouse gases for 167 years. He mentioned cellulosic ethanol. The same report in Science Magazine found, quote, biofuels from switchgrass, if grown on U.S. corn lands, increase emissions by 50%. The science study is one of many that have come to the exact same conclusion. Mr. Coleman mentioned UC Berkeley. I'm glad he did. Reminded me that Alex Farrell, who has long been a promoter of biofuels, after the Science Magazine report came out, he concurred with it, and he has and said that it was exactly right, and the issue of land use changes has not been discussed. A couple of other studies. In June 2007, two Colorado scientists, Jan Kreider and Peter S. Curtis. Jan Kreider is an engineering professor at the University of Colorado. Curtis is an engineering consultant in Boulder. Presented a peer-reviewed paper to the American Society of Mechanical Engineers that concluded that during the entire life cycle of ethanol, carbon dioxide emissions are, quote, about 50% larger for ethanols than for traditional fossil fuels. Such fuels are not the answer to global warming. They make it worse. Last fall, a study co-authored by Paul Crutzen, a Nobel Prize-winning chemist, found that due to releases of nitrous oxide during the production process, quote, commonly used biofuels such as biodiesel from rapeseed and bioethanol from corn can contribute as much or more to global warming, end quote, as fossil fuels. The Crutzen study is critically important because it confirms the finding of a 1997 report by the Government Accountability Office, a very credible organization, that determined that the ethanol production process produces, quote, relatively more nitrous oxide and other potent greenhouse gases. In contrast, the greenhouse gases released during the conventional fuel cycle, gasoline fuel cycle, contain relatively more of the less potent type, namely carbon dioxide. Ladies and gentlemen, the evidence is abundantly clear. When it comes to food and greenhouse gases, biofuels are a clear and present danger to our environment and our economy. They are a classic example of misguided government policy and huge subsidy programs that have run amok. Unless we change these policies, and soon, we could be facing a food disaster. A final point. Mr. Coleman said ethanol is now cheaper than gasoline. Well, thank God for that. It's 20 cents less, according to his figures. I trust him. That's fine. It's still more expensive than gasoline. Ethanol contains two-thirds of the heat energy of gasoline. Therefore, it should always be selling for a third less. It has never sold for a third less. Thank you very kindly.
Thank you, Mr. Bryce. And now for the affirmative side and our student debater, a familiar face here on these panels, Neil St. Clair. What's this, your third or fourth debate?
Neil? My third one.
And since you graduate, we may have to say goodbye.
Perhaps so. Maybe I'll come back for VU Law. We'll see. So, but thank you very much. It's been a pleasure and an honor always. Well, thank you very much. And one thing I can say, having done this debate before, I like Mr. Bryce, but I can tell you I've got a lot of assertions and no solutions. All he did was get up here and rail about biofuels for the next last 15 minutes, but he didn't offer any solution to our energy crisis, and that's what I intend to do today. Sure, there are negatives that exist with corn ethanol, but let's dedicate a little bit of time to the debate outside of the ethanol bubble and talk about renewables in general as a solution. Listen, I'm no scientific genius, but I can recognize one basic fact. America is in an energy crisis, and we'd better do something quickly. The solution's not drilling for more fossil fuels in Anwar to lower $110 barrels of crude. That's myopic. Instead, prudent long-term planning is what we need, planning that's focused on alternative, renewable sources of energy. Consider our side's energy policy as Darwinism, naturally selecting a more efficient and newer plan to replace a non-adaptive and outdated one. Fossil fuels playing the Neanderthal to renewable energy's Homo sapien. We need dynamism in our energy policy, not reliance on old methods, which, without any comparison, they seem to be relying on. Certainly, this will require the loss of some jobs and the killing of a major industry, but note that we haven't built any new refineries since 1970, and that merging the fossil fuel infrastructure into the renewable avenue is not mutually exclusive. But in the end, if we must trim the fat, let's do so in a way that benefits us economically and environmentally. Now, a few facts about non-renewable energy sources. Someday, we're going to run out of oil. Nuclear power is exceptionally expensive and potentially dangerous, and the idea of clean coal is downright oxymoronic. natural gas and propane fall into the same supply-demand problems of petroleum. So, given these difficulties with non-renewable sources of energy, we must find a way to be both economically and environmentally efficient with renewables. Now, according to the 1992 Energy Policy Act, these include ethanol-based and biomass fuels, electricity, hydrogen, and methanol. And I'm also going to throw in batteries, fuel cells, wind, solar, hydroelectric, tidal, and geothermal power, just for the sake of comprehensiveness. The debate shouldn't just be about biofuels, because there's a lot out there. Now, I contend that using a dynamic combination of these renewable fuels spread through a variety of consumption sectors, not just transportation, this is the most efficient method toward reduction of economic stress and climate impact. Now, first, let's take a closer look at some of the arguments against our current fossil fuel-based energy policy. Assume for a second that the political influence of big oil didn't exist. In this veil of ignorance, we understand that there's a link between climate change and what are known as anthropogenic greenhouse gases. The Department of Energy has already quantified the increased amount of emissions, and several scientifically valid studies attest to this. Beyond that, however, understand that our oil addiction has made America dependent on foreign oil. After Canada, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Mexico, Nigeria, and Angola make up the top five exporters of crude to the U.S. This opens American industries and consumers to great market volatility and weds us to unscrupulous regimes, not to mention resource wars of convenience. Furthermore, we must face the reality that any non-renewable energy will someday run out. You look at what's called Hubbert's peak oil, and according to that, we will run out of energy between 2075 and 2125. And this window is shrinking given the demands rising in India, China, and the Third World. Why ought America face these problems? Nostalgia for the combustible engine simply isn't a sufficient response. Now, let's examine some of the general benefits of renewable fuels, while not forgetting that there can be some drawbacks. Now, according to the Department of Energy, low prices for fossil fuels have kept renewables so far uncompetitive. This seems to be changing, as I'm sure you've all seen at the pump, with $4 gallons of petrol. Renewables make up only 7% of all energy used nationally. This is a trend that must change. For their part, Congress has recognized the need for renewables, evidenced in the 2005 Energy Policy Act and the 2007 Energy Independence and Security Act. Both are steps in the right direction, offering incentives rather than mandates for alternative fuel production. But still more needs to be done. Now, there are several various kinds of arguments against renewable, from efficiency to environmental impact. Many of these arguments at this time are valid, and this can be compounded by the need for a transition from fossil fuels to renewable. However, in any cost-benefit analysis, the detriment of fossil fuels, which we use now, are greatly outweighed by the positives of renewables. Now, I must caveat that while I'm a proponent of all renewable energy, I believe ethanol and other biofuels do need some time to mature. Heavily supported by the Bush administration under pressure from the farm lobby, these fuels are cleaner than standard petroleum, despite assertions otherwise, but still maintain some efficiencies. Yet, they are moving in the right direction, and biofuels and others should become an integral part of our energy policy in the future, to be sure. We must also think about solutions not only for the 28% of energy consumed by the transportation industry, but also by industrial, residential, and commercial sectors, which uses much or more energy. The true solution to our energy difficulties and the best way to attain energy independence is to apply natural methods of energy production, such as wind, solar, geothermal, and hydroelectric, to our non-transportation needs. These methods are typically greener than non-renewables and offer greater energy investment on return. An illustrative example is Rockport, Missouri, a town of around 1,400 people, now totally energized by just 4 windmills. Placed into my proposed matrix, energy independence on a larger scale is a concrete reality. Now, using these natural methods, I believe, will shore up some energy to take care of our transportation needs, either by electric, photovoltaic, or battery-powered. And I think this is the best way forward. Certainly, there will be some external expenses for creating energy-independent cities and transportation. But if America can't effectively organize renewable energy into a power grid system, the monetary rewards over time will be immense, not to mention the climate and geopolitical benefits. These all result in positive externalities. In short, I don't think that raising an alarmist bell about energy policy is the solution, but some action needs to be taken now to prevent catastrophe in the future. A comprehensive system of renewable energy resources implemented over a period of time will allow us to transition out of fossil fuels, making energy independence less of a pipe dream. And this will give us the inherent benefit of a green and economically stable America. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Neil. Another fine presentation for your record. And now our other student debater, arguing in the negative, Ashan Walpita. Welcome.
Thank you, Professor Zillman. Ladies and gentlemen of the House, I'm quite frankly disappointed with the stand of the proposition. It seems that their arguments are lacking in thorough analysis and are merely peppered with superficial statements and questions as to where the opposition gets funding for their research reports. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. St. Clair just concluded his speech by talking about renewable energy. I would like to reiterate the point brought up by our first speaker in that this opposition is not in opposition to renewables. We are all for renewables. But what we want to see stopped are unnecessary subsidies provided to them. Why? Because we already started to iterate that they cause inefficient market environments that cause implications, cause detriments to the global food market as well as the energy markets themselves. And we will go on to show to you that these unnecessary subsidies will only serve to create an artificial environment for these renewables to grow in, and hence are not really providing value to the economy. Now, having relegated the findings of the proposition and their arguments to being no more productive than a seventh grade report, I would like to go on to some of the very touching points of what this opposition stands for today. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about food. We're not just talking about fuel. We're talking about fuel that is derived from food, which is even worse. 6.6 billion people on this planet need to eat. 1 billion of those suffer from constant and periodic starvation, which means that this group are the most sensitive to fluctuations in global food pricing. The burden of using that same food for fuel purposes will stress the global food economy to breaking point. Ladies and gentlemen, this is evident in the fact that today, countries that never had to face the issue of starvation are actually starting to face them as a real, tangible outcome within the next few years. I talk about two contrasting extremes. One, Sri Lanka, a tropical island that is a developing country. And my home country. That is a country that has, for the most part, been secure in its agriculture, and to some part, secure in its economy. We've never had to face the problem of food shortages. But a recent report published 3 months ago stated that that is a real prospect that the country needs to face in the coming months, in the coming years. Why? It's because of the rising food prices that we've seen in the last 12 months. Food prices and examples that I will go into in a minute. Another example is a country such as Iceland. Now, why is a country such as Iceland, that is a developed country, facing such problems? The same problem exists because of the fact that they are heavily dependent on imports for food. So when you have huge fluctuations in food prices, they also are affected. I want to also touch on a very important point brought up by the first speaker of this opposition, in that even though we've had a record grain yield last year, we at the same time have faced the smallest amount of grain stocks on record. Now, what that means is that there's a smaller bumper, a smaller cushion to absorb shocks in the food market, such as crop failures, such as spoilage. What does that mean? That means that the pricing volatility increases. So the minute something small happens, even something small in the food market takes place, that effect is multiplied throughout with higher prices. We also believe, as the opposition, that this will continue to decrease the living standards of people in the developing world. Why? Because in the developing world, the consumer price index, nearly half of the consumer price index, constitutes food products. Whereas in the developed world, such as the United States and Europe, it's only 10%. Now, taking that into consideration, we realize that a change, a small or even a huge change in pricing, will cause the living standards to rapidly decline. Reports state that a one-third rise would result in a 20% decrease in living standards for the developing world. Now, what that means is that the growth potential for these developing countries will also begin to diminish. That means the economies of China and India and many other Latin American countries will begin to slow. Now, you might say, well, that's fine, but what does that mean for the United States and the developing world and the developed world? Well, simply, the largest companies within in the U.S. and that are listed as component companies in the Dow Jones and such have had the largest amount of revenue growth coming from the developing world. So when you start seeing a slowdown in that part of the globe, we are going to start feeling the effects here in the United States. We are going to see job losses. We're also going to see slower economic activity in this neck of the woods. This also leads to more geopolitical volatility. Ladies and gentlemen, as our first speaker pointed out to you, the tortilla crisis, food riots. This also puts a strain and a burden on international relations. And what that also means is that when countries can't feed their own people, they internally are going to start seeing volatility in their political spectrum. And what that will in the end lead to is a general volatility in the global geopolitical standpoint. Now, at the same time, what that means is that the U.S. will see a detriment in that many of these countries will see the U.S. as a primary source of higher food prices because of the United States policy towards biofuels. As a result, the U.S.'s cause of creating sentiment for security initiatives in the world will start facing more challenges. Ladies and gentlemen, to end my arguments for the opposition, I'd like to also state that the supply increases in grain that Mr. Coleman talks about that will come about by higher prices is an illusion. We realize that there are inherent constraints such as finite land and finite fertilizer and finite resource elements such as water, etc., that we will never ever really allow supply to reshift in that equilibrium point to allow for the present low prices to continue. Hence, because of these resource problems, we believe, as the opposition, that the illusion that higher prices in the short run will result in lower prices in the long run is an illusion. And to that, ladies and gentlemen, I rest my case on that.
Thank you. Well, we come to the part in the program where students or others in the audience who have an opinion on the issue at hand get your chance to make an argument for the position that you hold.
I'm a sophomore in the College of Arts and Sciences. One of my concentrations is environmental analysis and policy. And whereas being the tree-hugging hippies that we are, professors tend not to take a fierce stand on the biofuels issue, namely the ethanol issue, we are generally taught that it is, when you look at it, at least not better, if not worse, for the environment and the economy that is ethanol than standard fossil fuels. And we know, as the side over here said, the affirmative side said, that other renewable energies can and do work. The opposing side said this as well. For example, Minnesota and Oregon have wind power, but they also have a lot of wind. Sevilla, Spain is almost completely run on solar power, but southern Spain has a lot of sunlight. The big issue here, at least in my opinion, is research. And so I would wonder, disregarding the debate over ethanol causing more emissions, unless you're advocating action right now, which we all agree is necessary, why not divert this money to needed research on definitively less carbon-intensive energy sources, such as geothermal, hydrogen, and solar, which we believe, with more research, would be able to provide the needed amounts of energy with, you know, not turning the entire state of Pennsylvania into a wind farm? And so I guess that's more of a question, an open question.
That's fine. Thank you. That concludes tonight's debate. I think that It has been one of the most informed and informative that we've had in quite some time, and I think our participants are to be congratulated for that. We do have, in areas like this where the message is subtle, it is sometimes difficult to determine winners and losers, but it doesn't keep us from trying. And so I would like the those in the audience who felt that the positive side prevailed on the facts and in the rhetoric, gather on this side to my right. Those who felt that the negative side was more persuasive, gather on the left. And I will watch you assemble and quickly announce a winner. I'm going to announce the winner is the positive side and congratulate both groups on their fine presentation and thank you for your participation. Good night and we'll see you at the next great debate.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to Boston University's 25th Great Debate, sponsored by the College of Communications Department of Journalism. Tonight's question was, should biofuels and the renewables be critical components of U.S. energy policy? Arguing in the affirmative was R. Brooke Coleman, president of New Fuels Alliance, and student debater Neil St. Clair from the College of Communication. Arguing in the negative was Robert Bryce, managing editor of Energy Tribune magazine, and student debater Ashan Walpita, class of 2009 from the School of Management. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Journalism Department Chairman Robert Zelnick. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Jared Mooney, with help from Rachel Paste and Matt Sloan. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.